Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Monday, December 5th. Today, we're talking to Colorado Sun environmental reporter Michael Booth about both a recent climate conference held in Boulder and solar panels. Before we begin, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Pinnacle Assurance. Pinnacle underpins Colorado's booming economy with a different kind of workers' compensation insurance, one that puts care at the center of their coverage. Pinnacle has helped thousands of Colorado workers stay safer on the job through expert safety training. Learn more at pinnacle.com. They put care to work. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day in 1913, Colorado was hit by the most intense blizzard in the state's history. The storm, which started on December 1st and lasted for 5 days, brought heavy snowfall and rainfall to much of the state. Many towns east of the Continental Divide were buried under several feet of snow, while Denver and Georgetown saw over 4 and 7 feet of snowfall, respectively. Trains and other forms of transportation were halted, schools closed, and many people were stranded. The snow caused significant problems, including miserable conditions for striking coal miners living in tent colonies. The storm was so severe that it took days to dig out, and the snow remained in some areas into the following summer. Rotary plows and thousands of workers with shovels worked around the clock to clear stranded trains and over 200 Denver Tramway Company streetcars. The fire department used hoses to spray snow off sidewalks until the streets became saturated with water. In Denver, a hole was cut in the 16th Street Viaduct to allow flatbed cars to dump their snow into the South Platte River. The infant science of meteorology was unable to accurately forecast the storm, and many were caught off guard by its intensity. Despite the challenges, the people of Colorado were able to come together and work towards recovery. Even today, the 1913 blizzard remains one of the most severe and memorable events in Colorado's history. Before we continue, a quick message. Want to support visual journalism at the Colorado Sun? Here's how. The Colorado Sun's photographer, Olivia Sun, is a Report for America Corps member. Report for America is a nonprofit organization that helps place talented journalists in local newsrooms, and your support helps make their work possible. Help Olivia and the rest of the team by visiting coloradosun.com/RFA today. Next, our feature story.
Welcome back to the Daily Sun Up Podcast, Colorado. I'm Carol Wood, guiding you through today's conversation, and I'm grateful to be here with you today. And today we are visiting with the Colorado Sun's environmental reporter, Michael Booth. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Carol. Always happy to be here with you.
Thanks for coming by again. I always appreciate it, and I know our listeners do too. There's a couple things that you and I were discussing offline that we thought might be of heightened interest to our listeners and readers. And one of those things is a new kind of solar panel farm. And I'm always intrigued as to how those work in the first place. And maybe you can speak to what's going on with this new type.
I always have the same curiosity when I drive by a big group of solar panels. Who built them? Who owns them? Who's getting the electricity? Who paid for it? And I just think that this story about T-Mobile being the sponsor of a new set of solar panels east of Greeley was a really interesting business model. And I think people in Colorado will be seeing that more and more. So Namaste Solar partnered, they build a lot of solar panels and develop them, partnered with some finance people, Unico Solar being one of them, people who put together the money that it takes to build the front end of a solar panel farm, and applied for a community garden, the rights to build community garden solar that Xcel has to grant because Xcel has to connect into the grid, and Xcel only allows a certain number of megawatts of community solar to be built by others in a given year. And they had applied for these a few years ago and got approval. And then you go out and look for sponsors, and you need people. One way to do it is to go sign up a bunch of neighbors or a bunch of residents. And more you're signing up lower income residents who get subsidies and credits for the electricity that they're going to get through the solar panel. Other ways to do it now are to find a large sponsor, someone who wants to say that they're replacing a lot of their fossil fuel electricity with cleaner electricity. And so T-Mobile is one of those places that is doing this around the country. They're trying to go 100%. And I think they are now claiming that they have replaced 100% of their energy needs with clean, renewable energy. So they signed up to be the anchor subscriber to 4 megawatts of solar panels just east of Greeley that are built on some farmland, and they went online in early November and are now generating electricity. Of course, it doesn't go straight to T-Mobile's retail locations. It goes onto the grid, but T-Mobile can say that, and rightfully so, that they made it possible. And so the equivalent of 113 of their retail locations in the Rocky Mountain region are now powered by cleaner electricity.
That's a lot. And a couple thoughts I had. One, east of Greeley, I used to live up that way in Weld County, eastern Weld County. There's a lot of open land up there. It seems like a good place to plant a solar farm. It's also a high hail zone. How do these solar farms account for and mitigate when we have these huge hailstorms?
That's a great question. Maybe that's a story in itself in the future, because I don't know all the answers to that. I know that every time they site something, whether it's a wind farm or solar, they are extremely meticulous about seeing local weather patterns, knowing what the risks are. They obviously need to get insurance and bonding. And so they know that there's going to be a certain percentage of damage in a given year that they can account for, either through just replacement or the increased hardiness of the whole panel farm. So I don't know exactly how much damage they account for, but that's a very good question. We'll look into that in the future. The other thing about the open land that they mention is that it can be a way for farmers and ranchers, landowners who are kind of on the edge of the exurbs that are growing, ever growing outward from Denver and Fort Collins and Greeley, to keep the land as open, but make a little money because they are obviously renting the right of way and the lease to the solar panel developer, and keep it to be open land. And there are even companies that will come and run agriculture, run animals underneath the panels and build and plant things underneath the panels. So it's a way to keep the community in some agriculture while also obviously meeting the goals of renewable energy.
Yeah, that's interesting. I did not know that there was, you know, functionality underneath those pads, that they were that high off the ground. You know, when you drive by them, you don't realize then how high off the ground they are. That's interesting. So you mentioned also that, you know, XL Energy has, I guess, kind of limits on how much solar can be built. But what is it that XL has kind of dominion over when it comes to other private companies, Namaste or T-Mobile, wanting to do solar?
Well, they have the grid, and they have obviously used the public's money and the public subscriptions over the years and utility bills to build out this grid. It's a quasi-public endeavor. They're a private company, but they are heavily regulated by the government because they are a monopoly utility in the areas that they serve. So they have this grid that people can connect to, but XL has the right to get its costs back. And so they are building their own large utility scale solar, much bigger than the small farms that we're talking about, in order to replace their coal-fired power plants. And then they, in agreement negotiation with the Public Utilities Commission and others, community groups, they set aside a certain number of megawatts of new development of community solar that are built by smaller companies under this subscription model. And this was part of the wave that was awarded in, I think, about 2019, and now is just finally finished getting built out. And there was a new wave that we've talked about on the podcast in the past that is emphasizing more lower income residents and more subsidies to lower income residents to get the advantages of solar, even though they don't have ability to have it on their own rooftops. And so the process just goes on, and there will be more and more built every year.
Oh, super interesting. And Namaste Solar is they're a Denver company, right? I believe they're an employee-owned co-op.
Yep. And they do everything from the small panels on your own rooftop to larger commercial buildings to these smaller community garden and farms. And one thing they're also interested in getting into in the future that I think is also one of those drive-by intuitive things that you wonder why it hasn't happened before. The developers want to get more into using all those large rooftops out there on the warehouses, the Amazon warehouses, the big box retailers, the Home Depots of the world, the Best Buys of the world, all that acreage of space that faces the sun and gets very hot and it seems like a great place to generate electricity. Why aren't we putting solar farms on top of every single one of those? And there is more and more of the landlords of those places are interested in doing that as a way to defray their costs and get some money back from the leases. And so they said we should expect to all see more and more of those filled into the urban areas in future years.
You know, that's a great idea. I recently relocated and live not too far from a Costco distribution center, and that thing is enormous. And to your point, the rooftop of that would be, it seems, an ideal spot to have a massive solar farm.
It's prime territory. The grid already goes right by it and is already connected to it. So it simplifies a lot of things and it should happen.
Yeah, interesting. And, you know, it also provides a segue to something else that happened recently. That was a global climate summit at CU Boulder. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Over the first week of December, the first weekend of December, Boulder and CU Boulder were proud to host the Climate Change Summit. They are calling it the Right Here, Right Now Global Climate Summit, close on the heels of the COP27 International Climate Summit, where a lot of negotiations went on for the future of what countries will commit to in trying to slow climate change. And so this is a combination of local panelists and people appearing on Zoom and some keynote speakers and talking about everything from what are the current impacts of climate change that we're seeing on the ground in Colorado and in the air, to how local businesses can get involved in trying to come up with solutions and mitigation, to how to protect lower income communities from the damages that they've already been suffering from the environment and being the sort of the butt of a lot of dumping of bad air and other bad substances, and how can we keep that from getting compounded by climate change heating up their neighborhoods. And no good climate summit can come without a good protest. And so the CU students wanted us to know that they demonstrated in favor of the idea of divestment in fossil fuels, that the new money that the regions control and that CU Boulder controls and state government controls, they would like to see it divested as much as possible from anything involved in fossil fuels and things that promote climate change.
Well, I'm glad to hear the students are still active. I was, you and I were talking offline that that was going on when I was there, and around global climate issues. And so it sounds like they're still at it.
You mentioned before, people like to, you know, kind of snicker at student protests. I never do, because I think people should and are allowed to protest whatever their generation thinks is the most important thing. And they were the ones who, in my generation in college, got started on divestment from South Africa and apartheid. It took a while, but it made a big difference. And
right.
So I think we should always keep those examples in mind when we talk about what is the next level of protest.
I agree. And I remember when I was at CU, you know, they got the attention of the regents on several topics. So they're doing what they should be doing. And this particular Right Here, Right Now Global Climate Summit, it seems like it's quite a coup to have happened in Boulder, and quite the convening of keynote speakers. I noticed that Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland, was there. We had Sheila Watt-Coltier, a global advocate for Indigenous rights and health, and Kumi Naidu, also, who is a lifelong human rights advocate. So they had quite the lineup.
And a great mix of then local voices as well to echo what's happening locally from those international leaders. And so congratulations to CU Boulder for pulling that off.
It sounds like it was a great event. Well, thank you, Mike, for coming by again and sharing your environmental background with us and then your knowledge. And thanks to everyone who helped produce today's podcast, including our production partners at Pirate Audio. And have a wonderful day out there. And I sincerely hope that all of you can join us for the next Daily Sun Up.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Prominent Republican donor Steve Wells is taking back a large portion of the $11 million he committed to try to unseat Colorado Governor Jared Polis. Wells has refunded himself about $7 million from the super PAC he formed to try to defeat Polis and support Republican candidates. Wells said he is leaving about $850,000 in the committee's coffers for future political spending. He said he stopped spending about a month before Election Day after he realized other GOP donors were not opening their wallets in Colorado and as he saw how much money Polis was dedicating. The city of Thornton owns water rights in northern Colorado, but continues to fight other local governments to move the water south. The battle over 12 miles of its nearly 70-mile pipeline has stalled some development in Thornton and has officials back in court. Thornton looked north and started buying farmland and the water rights in the 1980s, when it had about 50,000 residents. Currently, the suburb north of Denver has 137,000 residents and is expected to have nearly a quarter million in 40 years. But pushback has developers who once eyed Thornton looking elsewhere. By next year, every employer in Colorado is expected to register and start funding for the state's new paid family leave law that provides paid time off starting in 2024. But before any payouts are made, the program needs to be funded. Employee payroll deductions and employer contributions start January 1st and are estimated to reach $1.3 billion by the end of 2023. paid family leave differs from the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, which is unpaid. Currently, 8 states offer paid family and medical leave, and 4 states, including Colorado, have enacted programs but not yet implemented them. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again on Monday. Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of the Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.